for those very kind words. It feels strange to be introduced by one of your former students who is now himself a distinguished professor. I want to thank, too, Dr. Patterson and the faculty and administration for giving me the honor of presenting these lectures this year. I consider it a great privilege and am very thankful to be here among you. The last time I was on your campus was during the throes of the change that the seminary went through, and at that time it was almost deserted. There was hardly anybody here, and it's so encouraging for me to see all the students here and hear the good reports of the enrollments. It's just wonderful to see what God is doing in your midst, and so I was very eager to come back and share in this lecture series. In 1985, Robert Funk, a prominent New Testament scholar, founded a think tank in Southern California, which he called the Jesus Seminar. The ostensible purpose of the seminar was to uncover the historical person Jesus of Nazareth using the best methods of scientific biblical criticism. In Funk's view, the historical Jesus had been overlaid with layers of Christian legend, myth, and metaphysics, so that he scarcely resembled the Christ figure which is presented in the Gospels and worshiped by the church today. The goal of the seminar is to strip away these layers and thus recover the original Jesus who actually lived and taught. In doing this, Funk hopes to ignite a revolution which will bring to an end what he regards as an age of ignorance. He blasts the religious establishment for refusing to allow the intelligence of high scholarship to pass through pastors and priests to a hungry laity. He sees the Jesus Seminar as a means of disabusing laymen of this mythological figure that they have been taught to worship and bringing them face to face with the real Jesus of history. The degree to which the Gospels have allegedly distorted the historical Jesus is evident by the edition of the Gospels published by the Jesus Seminar, called the Five Gospels because it also includes the Gospel of Thomas, along with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This version prints in red only those words of Jesus which are deemed by the fellows of the seminar to be authentic, that is to say, actually spoken by the historical Jesus. As it turns out, less than 20% of the sayings attributed to Jesus in the gospel were actually uttered by him and therefore printed in red. The real historical Jesus turns out to have been a sort of itinerant social critic, the Jewish equivalent of a Greek cynic philosopher. He never claimed to be the Son of God or to forgive sins or to inaugurate a new covenant between God and man. His crucifixion was an accident of history. As for his death, his corpse probably was thrown into a shallow dirt grave where it either rotted away or was eaten by wild dogs. Now, clearly, if these conclusions are correct, then we who are Christians today are victims of a massive delusion. To continue to worship Jesus today in light of these conclusions would be either idolatry or mythology. Idolatry, if you worship the purely human figure who actually lived. Mythology, if you worship the figment of the church's imagination. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want to be either an idolater or a mythologizer. And therefore, it seems to me that it is of utmost importance that we assess whether the claims of the Jesus Seminar are actually true. Unfortunately, the issues involved in this whole debate can be very complex and difficult, and I want to therefore try to address the issues fairly and responsibly, and yet not to lose us in a fog of specialist terminology and Greek words. I want to make it as simple as I can, and yet without becoming simplistic. So, are you ready? Here we go. Let's talk today about the presuppositions and the pretensions of the Jesus Seminar. I want to talk first about presuppositions. What is a presupposition? A presupposition is an assumption that you make before looking at the evidence. presuppositions are crucial because they determine how you interpret the evidence. Let me give you an example. Did you hear about the man who thought he was dead? This guy actually believed that he was dead, even though he was a living, breathing human being. Well, his wife finally persuaded him to visit a psychiatrist who tried in vain to convince him that he was alive. Finally, the psychiatrist hit upon a plan. He showed the man medical reports and scientific data to prove that dead men do not bleed. And after thoroughly convincing the man that dead men do not bleed, the psychiatrist took out a pin and pricked the man's finger. And when the man saw the drop of blood trickle down his finger, he cried out, "Ah, so dead men do bleed after all." The man's belief that he was dead was a presupposition that determined how he interpreted the evidence. His belief in that presupposition was so strong that it skewed how he looked at the facts. Now, in exactly the same way, the Jesus Seminar has certain presuppositions which determine how they interpret the evidence. Fortunately, the Jesus Seminar has made some of its presuppositions abundantly clear. The number one presupposition of the seminar is anti-supernaturalism, or more simply, naturalism. Naturalism is the view that every event in the world has a natural cause. There are no events with supernatural causes, or in other words, miracles cannot happen. Now, this presupposition constitutes an absolute watershed for the investigation of the Gospels. If you presuppose naturalism, then things like the incarnation, the virgin birth, the miracles of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, go out the window before you even sit down at the table to look at the evidence. As supernatural events, they cannot be historical. But if you're at least open to supernaturalism, then you cannot rule out such events in advance. You have to be open to looking honestly at the evidence that they occurred. In fact, if you don't presuppose naturalism, then the Gospels come out looking pretty good as historical sources for a life of Jesus. R.T. France, who is a British New Testament scholar, has pointed out that on the historical level, the Gospels are every bit as good a source of ancient history as other ancient historical sources. He says that whether you regard them as reliable is apt to depend more upon your openness to a supernatural worldview than on strictly historical considerations. In other words, skepticism about the Gospels is based not so much on history as on the presupposition of naturalism. And in fact, the Jesus Seminar is remarkably candid about its presupposition of naturalism. The introduction to the five Gospels states, "The contemporary religious controversy turns on whether the worldview reflected in the Bible can be carried forward into this scientific age and retained as an article of faith." And their answer to that question is a clear no. They state, "The Christ of creed and dogma can no longer command the assent of those who have seen the heavens through Galileo's telescope." But why, we might ask, is it impossible in a scientific age to believe in a supernatural Christ? After all, a good many scientists are Christian believers, and contemporary physics shows itself to be quite open to the possibility of realities that lie outside the domain of physics. So what justification is there for anti-supernaturalism? Well, here things get really interesting. According to the Jesus Seminar, the historical Jesus, by definition, must be a purely natural figure. And here they appeal to D.F. Strauss, the 19th century German biblical critic. Strauss's book, The Life of Jesus, Critically Examined, was based squarely in a philosophy of naturalism. According to Strauss, God does not act directly in the world. He acts only indirectly through natural causes. With regard to the resurrection, Strauss states that God's raising Jesus from the dead is irreconcilable with enlightened ideas about God's relation to the world. Now, listen carefully to what the Jesus Seminar says about Strauss. I quote, "Strauss distinguished what he called the mythical in the Gospels, defined by him as anything legendary or supernatural, from the historical." So we have a dichotomy here between the mythical and the historical. And what is the mythical? The mythical is defined as anything legendary or supernatural. Anything that is supernatural is by definition not historical. There's no argument given, it's just defined that way. They then go on to say, the choice Strauss posed in his assessment of the Gospels was between the supernatural Jesus, the Christ of faith, and the historical Jesus. So you have this radical divorce between the Christ of faith, or the supernatural Jesus, and the real historical Jesus. Now, the Jesus Seminar gives a ringing endorsement of Strauss's distinction. They state that the distinction between the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith is the first pillar of scholarly wisdom. But now the whole quest of the historical Jesus becomes a charade. If you begin with the presupposition of naturalism, then of course what you wind up with is a purely naturalistic Jesus. This reconstructed naturalistic Jesus is not based on the evidence, but on definition. He's defined to be purely naturalistic. And what is amazing is that the Jesus Seminar makes no attempt whatsoever to defend this presupposition of naturalism. It's just assumed. But this presupposition is simply wholly unjustified. As long as the existence of God is even possible, then you have to be open to the possibility that he has acted miraculously in the universe. Only if you are an atheist can you be justified in thinking that miracles are impossible. Now, this raises the very real question as to whether the fellows of the Jesus Seminar even believe that God actually exists. In a debate with John Dominic Crossan, the co-chairman of the Jesus Seminar, I raised this very question. I asked him, does the statement God exists have a truth value which is independent of human apprehension of that proposition? Does God exist even if there were no human beings around to believe in him? And after hemming and hawing and fudging and fidgeting, Crossan finally said, well, I guess I would have to say no. It was obvious that for Dr. Crossan, there really isn't even a God who exists outside of the human imagination. Well, if God is just a projection of human consciousness, if there really isn't anybody out there, then of course it's impossible that God has acted miraculously in the universe, as the Gospels claim. So the first presupposition of the Jesus Seminar, a presupposition which they make no attempt to justify, is naturalism and perhaps even atheism. Reject this presupposition and the whole reconstruction collapses. Now, if the historical Jesus is not the Jesus of the Gospels, the supernatural Jesus, then how do skeptical scholars figure out who the historical Jesus really was? Well, that leads to the second presupposition that I wanted to talk about this morning. Namely, skeptical critics presuppose that our most primary sources for the life of Jesus are not the Gospels, but writings outside the New Testament, and specifically the so-called apocryphal Gospels, the forged Gospels such as the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Philip, and so forth. These extra-biblical writings are said to be the key to correctly reconstructing the historical Jesus. Professor Luke Johnson, who is a distinguished New Testament scholar at Emory University in Atlanta, points out that all of the recent spate of books claiming to uncover the real Jesus follow the same predictable five-point pattern. It goes something like this. Number one, the book begins by trumpeting the scholarly credentials of the author and his prodigious research. Two, the author claims to offer some new, maybe even suppressed, interpretation of who Jesus really was. Three, the truth about Jesus is said to be discovered by means of sources outside the Bible, which enable us to read the Gospels in a new way, which is at odds with their face value meaning. Four, this new interpretation is provocative and maybe even titillating. For example, that Jesus married Mary Magdalene, or was the leader of a hallucinogenic cult, or was a peasant cynic philosopher. And five, it is implied that the traditional Christian beliefs are therefore undermined and need to be revised. If you hear of books following this familiar pattern, then your critical antennae should go automatically up. You are about to be duped. Because the fact is that there is no extra-biblical source which calls into question the portrait of Jesus painted in the Gospels. Let me just take a couple of examples which are favorite sources of the Jesus seminar to illustrate my point. First, the so-called Gospel of Thomas. The Jesus seminar considers this such an important source for the historical Jesus that they include it, as we've seen, along with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in their edition of the five Gospels. Now, what is the Gospel of Thomas? It's a writing that was discovered in Egypt just after World War II. It was part of a collection of Gnostic documents. Gnosticism was an ancient Near Eastern philosophy not dissimilar to the New Age movement today. And the so-called Gospel of Thomas is shot through with Gnostic philosophy. It was no doubt part of the literature of a Gnostic Christian cult, much like cults in our own day. Most scholars date the original to have been written in the latter half of the second century after Christ. Evidence of this fact is that the Gospel of Thomas uses vocabulary which comes from second century translations and harmonies of the four Gospels. And thus the vast majority of scholars today regard the Gospel of Thomas as a derivative source from the second century after Christ, which reflects the worldview of Christian Gnosticism. Incredibly, however, the fellows of the Jesus Seminar regard the Gospel of Thomas as an early primary source concerning Jesus, and they use it to revise the picture of Jesus found in the Gospels. Now, what reasons do they have for dating the Gospel of Thomas so early? Amazingly, their whole approach to this question is reasoning in a circle. It goes something like this. Number one, the Gospel of Thomas is an early primary source. Well, how do you know that? Number two, because no apocalyptic sayings are found in the Gospel of Thomas. That is, sayings about the end of the world, the coming kingdom of God, the judgment day, and so forth. Such sayings are not found in the Gospel of Thomas. Well, why is that evidence of an early date? Number three, well, this is evidence of an early date because Jesus wasn't into apocalyptic. Well, how do you know he wasn't? Number four, because the Gospel of Thomas proves that he wasn't. Well, why believe what the Gospel of Thomas says? Number one, because the Gospel of Thomas is an early primary source. And so around and around it goes. New Testament scholar Thomas Wright says, it's like Winnie the Pooh following his own tracks in the snow around a clump of trees. And every time he comes around and sees more tracks, he takes this as evidence that his quarry is even more numerous and more real than he thought before. It's no wonder that the fellows of the Jesus Seminar haven't been able to persuade very many of their colleagues on the basis of arguments like this. A second example is the so-called Gospel of Peter. Although this writing was condemned as a fake by early church fathers, the actual text remained unknown to us until a copy was discovered in an Egyptian tomb in 1886. Like the Gospel of Thomas, it bears the mark of Gnostic influence and also uses uniquely second century vocabulary, so that scholars unanimously regard it as a second century writing. Nevertheless, John Dominic Crossan, the Jesus Seminar's co-chairman, bases his entire reconstruction of Jesus' death and burial on the claim that the Gospel of Peter actually contains the oldest primary source about Jesus, and that the four Gospels were all based on it. Therefore, he says, the Gospels have no historical value for Jesus' death because they have no independent source of information other than this account found in the Gospel of Peter. Even though the Gospel of Peter itself does describe Jesus' resurrection, Crossan's naturalism prevents him from believing in the resurrection of Jesus. But with the biblical Gospels out of the way, Crossan can claim that the Gospel of Peter is just legendary and that there is no confirming testimony of Jesus' resurrection. Now, one of the strangest aspects about Crossan's reasoning is that he seems to have completely forgotten about the Apostle Paul. Even if Crossan were right about the Gospel of Peter's being primary, its testimony would still be independently confirmed by the writings of Paul, who refers to Jesus' burial and even lists the witnesses of his resurrection appearances. Thus, even if the accounts of the resurrection were based on the Gospel of Peter, there's no historical reason to deny the fact of the resurrection of Jesus. But in any case, Crossan's theory about the primacy of the Gospel of Peter's account is virtually universally rejected by New Testament scholars today. The prominent Canadian scholar Ben Meyer has called Crossan's arguments eccentric and implausible. Even Harvard University's Helmut Kirsta, who is about as radical and left-wing as you can get, rejects Crossan's reasoning as, and I quote, seriously flawed. There are no signs of literary dependence of the four Gospels on the account found in the Gospel of Peter. The obvious conclusion is that the Gospel of Peter is based on the four Gospels rather than the other way around. Thomas Wright sums up by stating that Crossan's hypothesis has not been accepted by any other serious scholar, and that the date and origin suggested by Crossan are purely imaginary. Now, what I've said about the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Peter could be said about all of the other apocryphal Gospels as well. According to John Meyer, a prominent American New Testament critic, the idea that the apocryphal Gospels offer us new information about Jesus is, and I quote, largely fantasy. The fact is that these writings are later derivative writings shaped by the theology of the second century and later. What this means, in the words of Professor Johnson, is that despite all the hoopla, the writings of the New Testament remain our best historical witnesses to the life of Jesus. The third presupposition of the Jesus Seminar that I want to talk about is that religion in general, and Jesus in particular, must be politically correct. In our day of religious relativism and pluralism, it is politically incorrect to claim that one religion is absolutely true. All religions have to be equally valid ways to God. But if you insist on being politically correct, then somehow you've got to get Jesus of Nazareth out of the way. For his radical personal claims to be the unique Son of God, the absolute revelation of God the Father, the sole mediator between God and man, are frankly embarrassing and offensive to the politically correct mindset. The Jesus of the Gospels is not politically correct. The desire to have a politically correct religion, and in particular a politically correct Jesus, skews the historical judgment of the Jesus Seminar. They dismiss as unhistorical any aspect of Jesus which they find to be politically incorrect. Historical judgments are thus being made not on the basis of evidence, but on the basis of political correctness. Nowhere is this procedure more evident than in the work of Marcus Borg, one of the seminar's prominent members. As a teenager, Borg lost his faith in God, Christ, and the Bible. But a few years after graduating from seminary, he had a number of mystical experiences which gave him a new concept of God. He says, "I realized that God does not refer to a supernatural being out there. Rather, God refers to the sacred at the center of existence, the holy mystery that is all around and within us." Yeah, if you intone those words just right, they might sound very profound and meaningful. But really, when you think about it, this is pretty thin soup as an understanding of God. After all, what does Borg mean when he says, "God is more than everything, and yet everything is in God"? Who knows? At any rate, Borg then reinterprets Jesus in light of his own mystical experiences. Jesus becomes a sort of cross-cultural religious mystic. Borg says, if we imagine Jesus in this way, it undermines a widespread Christian belief that Jesus is unique, which is commonly linked to the notion that Christianity is exclusively true and that Jesus is the only way. Rather than being the exclusive revelation of God, he is one of many mediators of the sacred. Here, I think it is very obvious that Borg's desire to have a politically correct religion has determined his reconstruction of the historical Jesus. As Douglas Guyvett points out, Borg's rejection of the traditional picture of Jesus has less to do with historical research about Jesus and more to do with Borg's own beliefs about God. The result of allowing political correctness to determine what is and is not historical is that you wind up creating an anachronism, a late 20th century Jesus who is just a reflection of yourself. And thus, Borg's Jesus turns out to be a social liberal driven by the politics of compassion to champion the rights of women and the poor against an oppressive social establishment. Jesus' ethos of compassion, says Borg, also implies the advocacy of gay rights and the provision of universal health care now. It's hard to disagree with Professor Howard Key's verdict. The fellows of the Jesus Seminar have succumbed to the temptation to create Jesus in their own image. They've looked down the long well of history and seen their own faces reflected in the bottom. In summary, the conclusions of the Jesus Seminar are based not so much on evidence as on the presuppositions of naturalism, the primacy of the apocryphal gospels, and political correct religion. Deny these presuppositions, and the whole reconstructed Jesus collapses in ruin. Now, at this point, some of you may be thinking to yourself, how in the world can New Testament scholarship be based on such flimsy presuppositions as these? Well, in fact, it's not. And that leads me to my second point that I wanted to make this morning, the pretensions of the Jesus Seminar. The Jesus Seminar portrays itself to the media as the representative voice of New Testament scholarship today, going over the heads of the clergy to tell unsuspecting laymen who have been duped by the church what Jesus was really like. They claim some 200 participants in the seminar who are supposed to be the embodiment of a scholarly approach to the New Testament. Just one evidence of this pretension is that they have named their translation of the Gospels the Scholar's Version, as though the teams of linguists and experts who produce such translations as the RSV, the NEB, or the NIV were not scholars. They're very anxious to portray themselves as disinterested historians, not theologians. This is the media image of the Jesus Seminar, a large body of objective historians, representative scholars, speaking boldly the unbiased truth. These are the pretensions. What is the reality? Well, the reality turns out to be much different. Their claim to have 200 scholars in the seminar is grossly inflated. That figure includes anybody who is in any way involved in the activities of the seminar, such as being on a mailing list. The real number of regular participants is about 40. And what about the scholarly credentials of the members? Of the 74 listed in their publication, The Five Gospels, only 14 would be prominent figures in the field of New Testament studies. More than half are basically unknowns who have published only two or three articles. 18 of the fellows have published nothing at all in the field of New Testament studies. Most of them have relatively undistinguished academic positions, such as, say, teaching at a community college. According to Professor Johnson, the numbers alone suggest that any claim to represent scholarship or the academy is ludicrous. Indeed, it is the seminar's claim to represent the consensus of scholarship that has really burned New Testament scholars. And I want to emphasize that I am not talking here about evangelicals or conservatives. I'm talking about the broad spectrum of New Testament scholars. For example, Howard Key denounces the Jesus Seminar as an academic disgrace and says that its conclusions are prejudicial and peripheral and not a substantive development in responsible scholarly study of the historical Jesus. According to Dr. Johnson, the real agenda of the Jesus Seminar is not academic, but social. He states, "The agenda of the seminar is not disinterested scholarship, but a social mission against the way the church is dominated by evangelical theology, that is, a theology focused on the literal truth of the gospel." Robert Funk does not conceive of the seminar's work as making a contribution to scholarship, but as carrying out a cultural mission. The seminar's declared enemies are not simply fundamentalists or the Southern Baptist Convention, but all those who subscribed to any traditional understanding of Jesus as risen Lord and Son of God. It is this socio-cultural agenda which drives the Jesus Seminar and determines its conclusions in advance. Far from representing the consensus of scholarship, the seminar actually represents the views of a radical minority on the left-wing fringe of biblical scholarship. It's no wonder that Jacob Neusner, one of the most prominent Jewish theologians of our day, has said that the Jesus Seminar is either the greatest scholarly hoax since the Piltdown Man, or else represents the bankruptcy of New Testament scholarship. Fortunately, the mainstream of New Testament scholarship has been moving in a much different direction than the left-wing fringe represented by the Jesus Seminar. Gone are the days when Jesus was treated like a figure in Greek and Roman mythology. Gone are the days when his miracles were dismissed as fairy tales based on stories of divine mythological heroes. Gone are the days when his empty tomb and resurrection appearances were written off as legends or hallucinations. Today, it is widely agreed that the Gospels are valuable historical sources for a life of Jesus, and that the correct context for interpreting Jesus is not mythology, but first century Palestinian Judaism. It is widely agreed that the historical Jesus stood and spoke in the place of God himself, that he proclaimed the advent of the kingdom of God, and that he carried out a ministry of miracle working and exorcisms as signs of that kingdom. I find it tremendously gratifying to see that the broad movement of New Testament scholarship in our day has been to confirm rather than undermine the traditional portrait of Jesus found in the Gospels. In particular, my own area of research concerning Jesus' resurrection has convinced me more than ever that the resurrection of Jesus was a historical event verifiable by the evidence. Tomorrow I propose to look more closely at some of that positive evidence for the life of Jesus. But for now, I think we can conclude that as Christians, we can be confident that the historical foundations of our faith stand secure. We can bet our lives on it.
All right, just remain standing, if you will, right where you are.